TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Dr. Aaron Thierry, The Brutal Logic of Climate Change. If you heard the first part of this talk on TUC Radio, you know that Dr. Aaron Thierry from the University of Sheffield, UK, presented a long list of evidence for climate change. His plan was to show that sea level rise, loss of polar and inland ice, changes in droughts, storms, etc., are all occurring at a faster rate today than science expected. Aaron Thierry's point, and even the understanding that forms the basis of the 2015 Paris Agreement, is that if we do not reduce fossil fuel emissions immediately, we're heading into a world that will be unlivable. That's why in Paris, the limit of warming was set at 1.5 degrees, not to exceed 2 degrees Celsius. In the part of his talk that you're about to hear now, Aaron Thierry presents a long list of actions that can be taken to keep the planet livable. He focuses on the so-called carbon budget. Since there's a clear understanding that rise in temperature and in emissions are directly related, we can now define how much CO2 we may emit before we hit the danger point. According to the brutal logic of climate change, humans on this planet may only extract, process, and use a small amount of the remaining coal, oil, and gas deposits in order to keep warming under 2 degrees. As societies, we need to carefully evaluate what exactly should be built with the remaining carbon budget, as the rest of coal, oil, and gas must be left underground. Are we going to use that precious carbon budget for more pipelines, airports, high-rises, roads, and factories that make useless stuff? Or do we build the windmills, solar arrays, and the renewable infrastructure? Here's Dr. Aaron Thierry. He starts with a couple of lines from the Paris Accords.
Here's the text from the Paris Agreement. I've picked out a part of it which says, "The goal of the agreement is to hold temperatures well below 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels and to pursue efforts to limit temperature increase to 1.5 degrees Celsius if possible, and that this agreement will be implemented to reflect equity," and that's really important, and I'll come back to that later on in the talk. At that point we go, okay, what do we have to do to meet those commitments? And the UK has got a commitment for 80% reduction in CO2 emissions equivalent by 2050. The EU have a similar pledge to do so by 60 to 80% in the same time period, and the world as a whole has said it will reduce emissions by half by 2050. But CO2 stays in the atmosphere for over 100 years. So long-term targets such as these are, in fact, I would say, dangerously misleading. And if I was to put it bluntly, I would say that these 2050 targets are unrelated to climate change. Now, why do I say that? The reason is that you have to try and think of the atmosphere as a bathtub, right? It's a stocks and flows problem that we're dealing with here. So as we're turning on the taps, we're filling up this bathtub. And basically, we're trying to stop the bath from overflowing, right? So we're currently opening and opening and opening the tap, and so more liquids or CO2 is going into the atmosphere, it's building up. If we go over and fill the whole circle, that means we've blown our budget for 2 degrees. So you can see we've now got to really radically reduce our emissions quickly if we're going to stay within this target. Because it's the cumulative emissions that matter. It's our budget. So this rewrites the chronology of climate change. It's not a long-term problem with gradual reductions. It's an urgent problem that requires radical reductions that have to happen now. So some people say that's too hard, right? So is aiming for 4 degrees more realistic? Well, for 4 degrees Celsius increase, then we'd again, peaking emissions in 2020, we would have to reduce them at about 3.5% a year, and then we'd end up with a 4-degree C world, right? Now, I, along with many other scientists, say that that's probably beyond adaptation for humanity. So this is Kevin Anderson. He's the former director of the Tyndall Centre. It's one of the leading centres for climate change research in the UK. He says, there is a widespread view that a 4 degrees Celsius future is incompatible with an organized global community. It is likely to be beyond adaptation, is devastating to the majority of ecosystems, and has a high probability of not being stable. Rachel Warren, who's an expert in food, agricultural systems, who works on these issues, has said, we have already observed impacts of climate change on agriculture. We have assessed the amount of climate change that we can adapt to, and there is a lot that we can't adapt to even at 2 degrees Celsius. At 4 degrees Celsius, the impacts are very high, and we cannot adapt to them. Even the World Bank has seen this and agrees, okay? So they wrote a report called Turn Down the Heat, Why a 4 degrees Celsius Warmer World Must Be Avoided. They go, there is also no certainty that adaptation to a 4 degrees Celsius world is possible. A 4 degrees Celsius world is likely to be one in which communities, cities and countries would experience severe disruptions, damage and dislocation, with many of these risks spread unequally. It is likely that the poor will suffer the most and the global community could become more fractured and unequal than today. The projected 4 degrees Celsius warming simply must not be allowed to occur. Okay. So if we're talking about adaptation, I think this is the take-home message, okay? The bottom line is that you've got to adapt to what that won't get mitigated, but you've got to mitigate what you can't adapt to. Mitigate's avoid by cutting emissions. Because at the end of the day, nature does not negotiate. Hans Schellenhuber, who advises both Angela Merkel and the Pope on these issues, has said, political reality must be grounded in physical reality, or it's completely useless. And this is the political reality that we're facing. So this is, again, the fossil fuel reserves that are proven and on the books of the oil, gas and coal companies today. So these are the reserves that they're predicting to dig up and mine. They've got them already there. They're in development now. And basically, it means that there's an extra 2,230 gigatons of CO2 available to be burnt. That goes beyond our remaining budget. The Bank of England have seen this. They understand that this is a threat to the economy as it is. And they've said that the vast majority of reserves are unburnable if we're to meet our 2°C commitments. But the fossil fuel companies don't see it that way. They're continuing to look for more resources and reserves. So this is the tar sands in Canada. Fracking, which they're trying to bring over to the UK now, do around Sheffield even. And even drilling oil in the Arctic now that the sea ice is starting to melt. So if you look at the business plans of a company like BP or Exxon, whose former CEO is now Secretary of State in the US, they're predicting to carry on growing in demand well into the 2040s, which would completely blow our carbon budgets. So the question's got to be, okay, why is it that they're selling that message? And it's the same reason as they've been funding climate denial think tanks for the last 20, 30 years. This is a network of all of these institutions are think tanks in the United States that ExxonMobil have given money to, and then the people around that are basically talking heads who spout climate denial nonsense on the television who work for these think tanks. Right? There's a whole network of dark money that exists to funnel money from these fossil fuel interests into these talking heads to distort the political debate and to make sure nothing happens, and so that they can continue selling this image of everything's going to carry on as normal, business as usual, our business plans are just the same as they've always been, and they're trying to own the future through their narrative. And it's not just fossil fuel companies, it's all different industries. So we've got committed emissions from building new power stations, from building new pipelines, from building refineries or airports or roads or combustion engine factories. They're all premised on the idea that the future is going to be the same as it is today. And that's got to stop. So this is a professor from Oxford University saying, investors putting money into new carbon-emitting infrastructure need to ask hard questions about how long those assets will operate for and assess the risk of future shutdowns and write-offs. For policymakers who think of climate change as a long-term future issue, this should be a wake-up call. Whether we succeed or fail in containing warming to 2 degrees Celsius is determined by what we do now, not in future decades. So every single investment decision that's being made, every single building that's being put up, every single planning decision that's being made about what our towns and cities are going to look like for the next 20, 30, 40 years is impacting our commitment to whether or not we're going to meet this budget or not. This is a quote by Jonathan Rowson, who used to work for the Royal Society of Arts. And I think it's really helpful to think about it. He says, the present that occurs now, that we're living now, is shaped by how an imaginary future was acted upon in the past. So the way that we live now is determined by choices that people made in the past based on how they thought the future was going to look. Risk assessment doesn't just represent the future. In altering behavior in the present, it also changes the future that ultimately elapses. And that's what I'm trying to do in this talk, right? I'm trying to inspire you to go out and change the future, because I'm saying this is what the future will look like if we don't do anything. That's not saying that's what it has to look like. It's saying this is our choice. We have to now choose to do something different. And that's also what the fossil fuel industry is doing. They're trying to shape a picture, an imaginary, a framework that says the future is going to be the same as it was. Of course it is. We've got everything being built to be that way. And if we go along with them, we know where that's going to lead. I've just shown you where that's going to lead. We've got to start breaking that mindset and saying, no, you're heading down the wrong path. So what solutions are there? Well, I think we've got all the technology that we need to solve this problem already, right? Whether or not that's wind farms or solar panels, or whether or not it's nuclear power stations or carbon capture and storage. I'm being agnostic on those. But the fact is, these things exist and they are coming down in price hugely for especially things like solar panels, right? The cost of producing that has fallen by 80% since 2008. The same is true for lithium-ion batteries. Again, another huge decrease in the cost. Wind turbine prices have fallen by 29% since 2008, and this was in 2012. The costs keep dropping. The technology exists, it's there, and it's affordable. And basically, all the energy modelers just can't keep up with the rate of change. In the same way as I was saying about climate scientists always being slightly conservative and always getting it slightly wrong about how fast climate's changing, the same is true for the energy modelers trying to keep up with the rate of change in the energy system. So we can do this. The technologies exist. We're already deploying them at a record rate. But time is of the essence, okay? These carbon budgets are really tight. And basically, there's not enough time to build all of that stuff. We have to reduce energy demand in the short term so as that we have time to build the energy supply that will take us to this low carbon, carbon neutral future that we need to get to. And I think there's huge opportunities for saving by reducing demand, because you're not only just saving the energy that you're not using, you're saving every bit of energy that's upstream to get us there. If we take, for example, 10 units of light from one of these light bulbs, there is an inefficiency in the way that the light bulb works. It gives out a lot of heat. It doesn't just generate light. That energy also then had to be transported to that light bulb through cables, which are inefficient, and there's resistance in those cables, which causes more energy to be lost. And those cables come from a power station, which burns coal or gas, which is inefficient. And therefore, you know, coal power station, you only use 40% of the energy that you put into it. The other is lost as heat. And then likewise, you've actually got to ship and mine coal to get to the power station in the first place, which is another inefficiency. So for every 10 units of light that you save, you've actually saved 133 units in terms of the overall energy that took to generate those 10 units in the first place. So by not using energy, we actually make a huge reduction in the amount of energy that needs to be produced. The electricity system demand-side opportunities dwarf those from supply in the short term, and that's really, really useful. But we can't use these savings to growth, and that's typically what's happened in the past. We've constantly been becoming more efficient at using energy, but we then just spend it doing more things, buying more things, and you know, having more lights. And we've got to not do that if we're to make this work. And the other thing that we have to do is that we have to think of the whole system as joined up together. So you have fossil fuel extraction on the one hand, then you have the combustion and the infrastructure that's used, and then you have the consumption, right? So if we're trying to reduce the consumption as much as possible, then it doesn't make sense to continue investing in infrastructure that is used for combustion and investing in extraction, like the current government is doing. They're just giving new tax breaks to the fossil fuel industry in the North Sea to get them to increase production rates. We can't do both simultaneously. You can't increase the supply at the same time as trying to reduce the demand. It just doesn't work. So we can't minimize the consumption of fuels whilst also maximizing supply. The other key point, and again, I think this has a message of hope in the same way as reducing demand does, is about equity. Now, around the world, there's hugely unequal usage of energy. So this is a plot from David Mackay's book, Sustainable Energy Without the Hot Air, in which he looks at different rates of CO2 emissions from different countries. And you can see that some countries have really high CO2 emissions relative to others. But this graph from analysis done by Oxfam shows us that if we take just the richest 10% of the world's population, they're responsible for half the world's emissions. And vice versa to that, the poorest 50% of the world's population are only responsible for less than 10% of the world's emissions. The inequality is that stark. So this problem doesn't need all 7 billion people in the world to act to solve it. It needs the richest 10% of the world's population to get acting to solve this. And it's the same within the UK as well. So it's not everybody that has to act on this problem. It's us. It's the people in this room, right? That's, I think, an inspiring message, because not only does that then land, obviously, a lot of responsibility on ourselves, but it also gives us agency to solve this problem. We can be part of the solution to this problem. So how to make progress? So often people will say that there's lots of barriers to dealing with this problem. They'll say, for example, that scientists haven't warned us clearly enough. Well, hopefully that's not true, and I'm trying to make sure that that's not true tonight. They'll say that our electoral system is too short-term, or that we don't have the technological alternatives. Again, I don't believe that's the case. I've tried to show you why that's not the case. Our economy doesn't properly cost harm. We're too lazy to change our habits. International treaties have no legal enforcement. Our culture encourages consumerism. All of these are being put forward as reasons why we're not going to solve this problem, why it's too hard to deal with. And climate change is a complex problem. It's often referred to as a wicked problem because there are so many interacting parts that all have to be addressed. But we can flip that on its head, right? That means that all of these are potential avenues and opportunities for tackling this problem. Everybody has a role that they can play. Whether or not they're interested in science or culture or technology or behavior or the law or democracy or the economy, you all can do something about this. Because we need everybody. And there's a report called The Seven Dimensions of Climate Change, written by Jonathan Rowson from the RSA, who I mentioned earlier, and the Climate Outreach Information Network, which looks at each of these and says, well, if they're all important, what can we do in those different categories? And I'm just going to pick out some things that spring to mind, right? So here's a book by Barbara Kingsolver about the impacts of climate change. It's a great book as well. Technology, right? Here's people building and deploying and researching solar panels. Here's people designing and implementing new architectural buildings that are passive house designs that don't require any energy or light to heat. Here's a gentleman who's, you know, a real technological technophile installing a Tesla battery on his wall in South Wales. Right, there's all things that we can do. Behavior, there's the individual changes that we can make in terms of fixing our light bulbs and choosing what we buy and where we go to travel and all of those things. But then there's also social things, like the municipalities choosing to put in the right infrastructure to help us get around without putting out emissions, such as the forest bike scheme in London, or otherwise larger scale behavior change, like the Transition Network, who are looking at how we can reshape our communities to deal with these problems. The law, so this is first one is from the Netherlands, where citizens in the Netherlands sued their government for failing to have strong enough climate targets, and they won. And now the government's got to reevaluate its plans and implement stronger targets. We've got Client Earth, who have recently sued and won against the UK government so that they have to clean up air pollution in the UK. We've got here a group of young people, 10 to 18 years old in the United States, who are suing their government to try and get them to take stronger action on climate change. There's things that we can do. We've got democracy, whether or not that's choosing to vote for politicians who actually mean to take action on climate change, or it's getting involved in making mass protests and making your voice heard and showing that there's demand for change on these issues, or lobbying politicians to implement laws to deal with this, such as the Climate Change Act in 2008, which was world-leading and has inspired many other countries to implement similar laws as well. There's the economy, there's the divestment movement, which an example was People and Planet's campaign here on campus, which successfully got the university to stop investing in fossil fuel companies and instead invest in other companies, renewable energy companies. The university now invests almost £1 million in two major solar companies. You've got local community solar projects where people have come together, invested their money in renewable energy, and not only does that have obviously a benefit for the climate, but it also brings back investment into the local communities. And you've got as well a list of major multinationals who have signed up to the 2 degrees Paris pledge, and they said that they're going to support governments to achieve that goal. And then you've got scientists who obviously have to keep doing their science, producing their reports. But they're more than scientists. And this scheme, More Than Scientists, allows scientists to put up videos of themselves explaining their hopes and fears for the future and what they're doing to try and bring about change on these issues. And you've got here a photo of James Hansen, who I mentioned right at the beginning is former director of NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies and a climate scientist himself, being arrested outside of the White House trying to stop fossil fuel projects being built. I think many people find it hard sometimes when you're in the midst of one of these transitions to see that the future can be different. I love this quote because it comes from an English tourist in Edinburgh in 1725 to 26. And he was commenting on the fact that they basically at night time just tipped all their chamber pots out into the street. And the stink in the city was unbelievable. That's why Edinburgh is known colloquially as the Old Reeky. But he wrote that anything so expensive as a conveyance down from the uttermost floor could never have been agreed upon, nor could there be made within the building any receiver suitable to such numbers of people, by which he means a toilet. But here's a photo of Edinburgh with all the sewage pipes running down the side of the building, taking away their waste. This was a massive infrastructure project that took place in cities around the world as a result of trying to make a planet a better place to live. And you can see again, London, this is Fleet Street, digging up in the Victorian times, the entire street, really, really deep in order to lay and build all these sewage tunnels. Right? These are substantial changes that were made in order to deal with these problems, and we can do the same. And change can happen really quickly. Okay, so this is a photo from 1900 of Main Street in New York City on Easter Day Parade, and you can see all of these carriages are horse-drawn carriages. Just 13 years later, 1913, there's only one horse-drawn carriage in that photo. The rest are all motor cars. Now, if we look outside and we see combustion engine vehicles going up and down our streets at the moment, we could equally return there in 13 years' time from now and see them all electric buses and cars and bicycles. Here's another great example. Here's a quote from Peabody Energy, one of the world's largest coal producers. They released a report in 2010 which said, coal's best days are ahead. They went bankrupt in 2015. This change is happening really quickly, but it's being resisted. Okay? There are a huge number of incumbents and vested interests who are doing everything they can to stop this change from happening. And we have to fight back and resist against them. And so here's an example of Ben Van Beurden, CEO of Shell, just said this just the other week. If we are not careful, broader public support for the sector will wane. This is the biggest challenge that we have at the moment as a company. The fact that societal acceptance of the energy system as we have it is just disappearing. Well, good, that's fantastic. But it's terrifying to me that he sees this as a problem. So we cannot create what we can't imagine. We have to imagine a different world. And the people in these companies and many of the institutions that we currently have are just not seeing the world in a different way to the one that is business as usual. And they have to start seeing it a different way. We have to show them how it can be different. That is our task. That's our life. And there's lots we can do locally even, right? So this is a report from the University of Leeds. It's called the Mini Stern Review. And it looks at Sheffield City region in particular, and it says, within the Sheffield City region, there is a very considerable potential to reduce energy use and carbon footprints through cost-effective and neutral investments on commercial terms. And they actually show that we could reduce emissions by 40%, and that would be at no net cost, and it would pay for itself within 8 years. And that would also return more savings to the local economy as well. So why aren't we doing that? Why aren't we putting pressure on our politicians to do that? Here's a report from the University of Sheffield that just came out the other week. Well, it's in partnership with some other organisations, including the University of Hallam, Sheffield Hallam. But not once in that entire report, which is setting out a plan for the next 25 years for the Sheffield City region, do they mention the words climate change, decarbonisation, or anything of the sort. Why not? You know, how can it be that a report outlining what the city could look like for the next 25 years isn't even touching on these subjects? We can't let that happen. We have to raise our voices. So this whole talk, I know it can be a bit depressing. People have said that to me, but this is how I look at it, okay? This is not a message of futility, but it's a wake-up call of where our rose-tinted spectacles have brought us. Real hope, if it is to arise at all, will do so from a bare assessment of the scale of the challenge that we now face. We have to look at this problem as the challenge of our lives, and we have to act as though this is a planetary emergency, because it's on that scale. Well, seeing as that you're all alarmed, here's some things I can suggest that you might try and do. So one is inform yourself. You're already doing that. You're here at this lecture, but there's lots of great resources and books outlining both the problem and its solutions out there to help you communicate this with other people. Obviously, reducing your own carbon footprint is important, whether or not that's changing your diet, changing your energy uses, changing how you travel. That all helps. But don't get hung up on this. It's far more important that you increase your political footprint. Come together, join either campaign groups, join a political party, join a community, and try and make change happen together. Because it's only through putting our voices together that we'll be loud enough to stand up to the fossil fuel interests at this point. And although we know where the future is going to be, and the future is going to be green, the timescale matters, and we have to make this transition as quickly as possible. So thank you very much for your time. The last three things is, if you go about your life, try and remember these three things. Try and, wherever you can, power down the amount of energy you use, reduce, reuse, recycle, power up low carbon energy supplies, and keep it in the ground, prevent fossil fuel extraction. And if you make all your important life decisions about which jobs you go into and all of those things based around these three questions, then we perhaps have a chance of fixing this. Thank you.
That was the conclusion of a one-hour talk entitled The Brutal Logic of Climate Change by Dr. Aaron Thierry. He received his PhD in ecology from the University of Sheffield and researched the impacts of global warming on the carbon cycle in Arctic ecosystems. He now spends much of his time lobbying for political action to reduce carbon emissions. Thanks to CNU, that's Carbon Neutral University at Sheffield, for organizing and recording this talk. The date was March 26, 2017. You can see all the slides and charts Aaron Thierry is using on YouTube. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. While you're there, you can subscribe to weekly free podcasts. Downloads are free, and we appreciate any size donation to keep TUC Radio on the air. Our email address is tuc@tucradio.org. Time of useful consciousness is an aeronautical term. It's the time between the beginning of oxygen deficiency and the loss of consciousness. Time for useful projects to rescue the planet and the plane. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.